once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Yes. This time it's English.
Yes.
Just as a matter of record, that is a quote from Shakespeare's Henry V, The Battle of Harfleur. And we say it because every time we go on the air, we have the opportunity to fill up our career with our own words of things that need to be totally corrected, absolutely wrong or whatever. Anybody can be wrong at any point. Please keep that in mind. That includes economists, doctors, attorneys, politicians, police officers, and anybody else. So if I didn't list you in there, please believe I wasn't trying to insult you, and do not be triggered. There you go. So what do we have to talk about this particular hour? And I have probably, as we say, generally you have an elephant in the room. This week we have an elephant in the house. And we will discuss the elephants in the house.
I'm interested in hearing what the elephant is that you're referring to.
Well, it is a symbol for a political party.
Oh.
So the elephants in the house that generally we would say, hey, let's not ignore the elephant in the room. In this case, there's elephants in the house that are on one end of the house of elephants saying no. And on the other end, the majority of them are saying, well, yes. So there is a political struggle in the GOP. In the Republican Party, and you can see it in Texas at the state level. You can see it in just about everywhere where the Republicans are in charge right now. This is running parallel with the elections, the presidential elections, because there's a group of people that are saying one thing and a group of people that are saying a completely different one. If you follow politics, know what those groups are. It really doesn't matter from a big picture viewpoint, from the economics viewpoint. What we're looking at here is that we have two political parties. And when you have two political parties, they generally pit themselves against each other. When one party gets to be in charge, so they say have both House and Senate and the executive branch, the presidency, or at the state level, they have the House, the Senate, and the governor, lieutenant governor, all that stuff. You tend to start to see whichever party that is splinter and fight each other, because now they don't have to fight the other party. They have their own little agendas to deal with, and it becomes the two ends of the parties political spectrum rather than the two ends of the country's political spectrum. So in Texas, we have the hard right fighting the not quite so hard right. At the federal level, we have the hard right fighting the not quite so hard right. When I say this is, it's kind of irrelevant about parties. This is why demographically, when we look at a big picture, we see the same thing happening in Europe. The hard right party is fighting the not so hard right party. But the left wing party is kind of standing off to the side and going, what is going on right now? But not having as much sway as they used to, as the others bicker that are generally partners. And we see this repeatedly in history. Why am I bringing up politics in economics? Because where the government is a big chunk of the economy. They have federal employees that receive a very large amount of money. There's defense spending that is a very large amount of money. The GDP and the government of the budget, we measure our debt per year as a percentage of GDP. We measure our budget per year as a percentage of GDP, and it's a pretty good chunk of it. We're talking about 20 to 30% of the economy. And while we were terrified earlier in the year because we didn't have enough money to pay the bonds if the government shut down, now we got enough money on hands for extraordinary measures again. We can do that. It's going to be expensive if we have to do that, with interest rates being what they are. If we jump in and try to make a bunch of bonds, get a bunch of loans, we're going to get it at a higher interest rate. This is what happened just a few months ago when we avoided a government shutdown. The government has to spend more money on its bonds now because it's more expensive because they threatened the shutdown, and they're doing it again. In this case, we have enough money to pay the bonds, at least for a while. Who's going to be affected by this? Federal employees. Is basically, if you work for the government, if you are in the military, if you are any type of federal employee, you're going to get no money. You're going to be told to stay at home. And in some cases, if you're told to stay at home, you don't get paid. In other cases, you get paid for your time for not working, which is more expensive for the government because they paid you for doing no work, which is really a bad idea if you're trying to cut back on the budget. You know, people that have listened to us for very long know that we believe in responsible spending at the governmental level. And we point the finger at everybody, including ourselves, saying we're spending a lot of money, way more than we're taking in tax revenue. And we could be taking in more tax revenue by raising taxes. We're not. I certainly don't want personally higher taxes. But when we look at the government, that might be a deal. Nobody wants to do that.
We could also take in considerably more tax revenue. It wouldn't quite balance the budget, but it would get it within range of making it work by simply increasing the funding to the IRS, because the probably detectable, if you had the manpower to do it.
See, now you're really stepping in the minefield, giving money to the tax collectors.
Right. And the bottom line to it is, if you don't like the huge deficits and you don't like the huge national debt, the least painful way to correct that would be to allow the IRS to audit, in other words, look at the various returns that they have flagged as unlikely to be correct. They don't have the manpower to do this. Matter of fact, since the cuts by Congress in their budget, they have basically stopped doing walk-in audits. In other words, where they come to your business, they don't have the budget for it. They don't have the manpower for it. And in doing so, there is probably something approaching the amount of the deficit in illegally unpaid taxes.
It may not be that high, because I've seen estimates that it's a quarter of the deficit. So what are we saying here? None of us like the concept of being audited. I don't like the idea that the IRS could show up with no cause and want to audit us and shut down basically our time for an extended period of time to get data back to the government. However, if our system is based on paying taxes when you owe the taxes, then we have to enforce it. That's just the reality. If we had a law that says you're not allowed to kill, but we're not going to hire anybody to arrest you for it, then the law probably won't get followed as well as we want it to. And paying taxes in the United States is, both parties agree on this. I know that's weird, gasp a minute, that everybody, as far as the majority of both parties, agree that if you're cheating on your taxes, that's bad. Yep, we in the United States agree on that. That's not true in Mexico. It's not true in Greece. It's not true in many countries where they believe that everyone else should pay their taxes, but I shouldn't. And that's on surveys. People answer this on anonymous surveys, and it's across lots of countries. In the United States, we believe that it's important that you pay your taxes if you owe them. And I think that's a cultural standpoint that we don't want to get rid of. Eventually, if we don't enforce that you pay taxes, people will lose that belief that it's important to pay your taxes. Because some component of the fear and wrath of the IRS is why some people pay taxes. They would not pay taxes if they weren't terrified that the IRS was going to show up one day. The majority of us are willing to pay the taxes if we know what we owe. And, you know, it's no fun. I don't want to write a check to the IRS, but I recognize that's my price to exist in this country and get all the benefits that I get in this country. So paying taxes is important, making sure you pay the right amount. And we happen to have an extremely, extremely complex tax code. So there's another thing we could do to make this work better. We could simplify the tax code, not simplify the way you file taxes, but simplify the code itself. I know this is a pipe dream, but the reality is that no one person anywhere understands the United States tax code in its entirety. It's too complex. You have experts on specific parts of it that are kind of sort of familiar with other parts of it, but it's way too complex. There's different tax brackets for different commodities. There's different approaches to managing retirement accounts, if they're qualified, non-qualified, if they're government or non-governmental, and it's never been simplified. So we spend a huge amount of money on tax preparation. And if you consider that tax preparation, money paid to prepare taxes above just knowing how much you spent, organizing it the way that the government wants it when it's so obtuse and difficult, we spend a huge amount of money on that. If instead that money went to tax revenue, and at the same time, we made it simple enough to know when you owed. Because a lot of people, even with all the efforts out there today to check to see if you own digital assets, what does that mean? Like cryptocurrencies. A lot of people that made money in the crypto boom simply didn't pay any taxes on it. We're talking about billions, like with the B, lots of those billions during 2021, early part of 2022. There were a lot of sales with huge gains that simply aren't getting taxes charged on them because the IRS isn't geared up to chase them down. At this point, that money's been spent, but that doesn't mean we can't go and claw that back and do the auctions like we did for Willie Nelson. I'm not saying that Willie Nelson is, and I think he's my hero, but he didn't know that he was supposed to be paying taxes way back when his tax issues arose. And the tax code is a lot more complex today than it was back then. So if we made it simplified, it would cost less to do taxes. It'd be easier to know what you owed. So the government would actually get the revenue and it would be timely. Most businesses at this point don't file their taxes until September for the previous year. That slows down revenue growth. You can't get the taxes in if you don't know how much is owed. So why do they wait so long? Because the complex tax code is so complex that it takes 9 months after the year's been done to figure out what the year was. I mean, you know what it was, because if you have more money in the bank, you made a profit. But if you're a business owner, this is to the choir. You could totally know this already. If you're an employee of a corporation, you may not. So there are things we can do immediately without changing a lot of the structural stuff to simplify, to enforce. But we really need a simplified code that will increase revenue. The more complex it is, the more you can find loopholes. If you have a complex system, you can find weaknesses in that complex system, and you can see those weaknesses in lots of people's returns. So, go ahead.
There's an example that was presented to Congress when they were having hearings on reducing the IRS budget. The commissioner of the IRS commissioner, who's the head of the commission, said, among other things, they're investigating. 100 of the wealthiest Americans who claim residency in Puerto Rico, but in fact don't live there. Because Puerto Rico, even though it's technically part of the United States, they don't pay federal income tax. And there was a whole series of others. For example, there are people who can buy a literally stable of the highest, most expensive cars that they've identified who aren't even filing an income tax return. And this takes manpower to go and investigate, to figure out how people can buy build the big garage with multiple places in it and buy the most expensive cars from Europe and still not owe any income tax. And those are the things that they were using the budget increase they had. He listed those at the top of the list, and they're on hold now, those issues, because they had their budget cut. And I realize it's very unpleasant. I don't care for the IRS. I will say that I've heard some terrible horror stories about IRS agents doing stupid things. Personally, I have survived an audit very nicely, and I have used the ombudsman when things were tight, and the IRS was very worked with me very well so that I could pay off my taxes in a manner that didn't destroy me during some downturns we had in the past. But there doesn't seem to be, factually, a serious intent, particularly in the House of Representatives, to lower the deficit. They want, and this is kind of a goofy thing, it's as if whatever party is not in power wants a high deficit. You mentioned various parties shutting down the government at various times. They want something that people don't like so that they can position themselves as being against it so that they can raise the interest in their party. And whichever party is out of power, not having the White House and the majority in both houses, tends to do exactly that each time. And this is unfortunate, to say the least, because that's one of the problems we have right now. And I think you may have mentioned this, but we spend about 1.5 times in the United States the revenue that the United States government takes in. every year, very consistently. And why? Well, there's nothing in the there's nothing major in the budget that anybody wants to cut.
And we keep adding to it.
And we keep adding to it.
And I mean, from our perspective, these aren't easy. There are no easy answers here. We're not saying, hey, let's cut defense. We're not saying cut Medicare. We're not saying cut Social Security. Those three items are the vast, vast majority of the revenue we take in. You add retirement,
well,
on other retirement services on that, and the medical services on that, and it's more than we take in.
If you just pay retirements for soldiers and the civil servants, yeah, plus Social Security, plus Medicare, plus the defense budget each year,
that's it. We're done. That's the based whole, on that's current, whole taxes.
Well, we'd still run a deficit.
Yeah.
We don't take in enough taxes to cover those three items.
And that's not even touching on the interest on the debt, which has gotten bigger. So the reality is that there's no easy place to cut. None of those things. We do not want to cut defense when China's acting the way it is and Russia's acting the way it is. We certainly don't want to cut off pay to Social Security or Medicare. Well, what does that leave? It leaves we either need to charge more for Social Security and Medicare because it's not going to work otherwise. We need to maybe move the retirement date for Social Security. We need to means test. There's a lot of choices there. Nobody likes those choices. The only other factor here is how do we raise the revenue? When we lowered taxes for corporations, we had a net kind of break even. We got a bunch of revenue in on taxes that were owed from the past. They got their amnesty. They brought some money back. It came back to the United States. This was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and it was during the Trump administration. And it worked really well in simplifying and lowering the overall rate for corporations. So revenue has been a net neutral. It's gone up with earnings with corporations. We didn't lose money at the governmental level by lowering taxes there. If we lowered taxes again, we probably would lose money in revenue there. When we lowered taxes on the personal income side during that same time period, we lowered revenue to the government. As a percentage of the GDP, we made less money in taxes after we lowered the personal income tax rates. That's not fun for me to say because I enjoyed the lower taxes. I am enjoying the lower taxes. They're going to go back up in 2026. That's not because somebody's going to pass a law to do it. That was part of the original law. It's going to go back up on the personal side in 2026. So revenue should probably rise there. I'm not excited about it. We're doing advice to clients about how to take advantage of the low rates while we can to get lower payments while we can. If we have taxes due now, we should probably pay them now rather than wait to pay them at a higher rate. Those are all things that are components, but when there's a government shutdown pending and we can't even agree on what we're trying to agree on, things are not good.
There have been several surveys recently of members of Congress and a lot of work going into this. And apparently the 2026 rise in income taxes that the, what was it? Was that Secure One? What was the?
It was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Okay. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has in it an increase back to the previous tax rates in 2026.
Yeah. It was passed in 2017. You can't make a personal income tax change of more than 10 years without a much larger number of votes. And it passed party line votes. No Democrats voted for it. So they couldn't say it's permanent. It had to last the 9-year period. They passed it in 2017. It goes away in 2026.
Well, the surveys I have seen indicate that there is a majority in both parties who want to extend the tax cuts after 2025.
And personally, I would love that. But when I look at the health of the country, I go, oh, that's probably not a good idea. What is that? That's a dichotomy there, that we can all sit around and complain about the debt. We can say that debt is horrible and we're overspending, but at the same time, we don't want taxes to go up. And that's the conundrum we face now. I don't have an easy solution for that. I mean, there's an easy solution. I just wouldn't like it, which is raise taxes. It's going to happen anyway if the Congress doesn't pass a law to make it not happen, and then we'll see if revenue goes up. So that is the elephant in the house. We have not ignored it. It's there. There have been times that it was, I'll use the politically correct donkey in the house that has been in the same situation. So please don't think that we're a fan of one animal over the other. They're both politicians when they get to Washington, so we can revile them equally. How's that? And somebody volunteered to be in that position. I hear a lot of people complaining about Congress, and I ask if they're really willing to run, and I get this universal look of absolute disgust on people's faces. No, I do not want to put myself in that ick. I will get in the mud with the pigs, but the pigs will like it. I will not, though. What else? I mean, I've got some stuff dealing with unions, the inflation rates in the rest of the world. What do you got right now?
Well, I guess I'm focused very much on the big picture. And the big picture is longer-term rates are likely to rise. Bill Ackman, who founded the Pershing Square hedge fund, which has been an astonishingly effective investment, is saying that the long-term treasuries that are currently sitting about 4.4% are going to rise to 5.5%. And he has a very, very good argument for that. Basically, the Fed has accepted, even in their official statements, 2.5% inflation. And probably, since our long-term historic average is around 3%, probably we're looking at 3%. So historically, how much higher than inflation does the Fed have to pay, at the United States Treasury have to pay, to get people to invest in longer-term bonds? And the answer is that we will see bonds out there at 5.5%. I think that's probably going to continue to be true. And this is something I think people... There are still people who are anticipating a massive cut in interest rates as we slide into a recession. That was the big argument. And all the reports we're getting right now is that there's a lot of money moving from stocks into bonds. I think it's another case where the majority of retail investors, whatever they're doing, if you do the opposite, you probably make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And people are moving out of stocks into bonds.
John Templeton has a great quote on that. I believe in being a conscientious investor. When the market wishes to sell, I oblige them and I buy. And when the market wishes to buy, I oblige them and I sell. Mm-hmm. Well, the market wishes to sell right now. I think we should oblige them and not do it at the same time that they are, because that is a very traditional way of making a small fortune in the market. How do you make a small fortune in the market? Start with a big one. Do what everybody else does and you will have a small one.
And I think it's just taking a lot of time for people to recognize that what happened over the last 10 or 20 years was abnormal, and that we will go back into a more normal condition and probably, as you mentioned earlier when you read that headline, stay there mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm. The normal condition is that 30-year treasury bonds pay 5.5% to 6%. The short-term rate is around 3%, and it steadily rises as it goes along to the maturities. And I think we're going to see that again. What does that mean? Short-term, the Fed is saying that they expect the high short-term interest rates to persist at least until the end of 2024.
What does that mean? It means that if you are sitting on an investment property and you're trying to sell it, and you're saying, man, or you're waiting to buy a house, and you're saying, I'm just going to wait for the interest rates to go down, it may be a lot longer than you think. What's happening across the people that are waiting to buy spectrum is that the savings rate in that group is going up significantly. People are slowly starting to come to the conclusion, I've been saving to buy a house, I need to save a while longer so that the amount of money I put down on this house is going to cause my payment to be low enough. The other factor here is that the square footage on an average new house in 2023 for the first time in 40 years is smaller than the square footage of 2022. New houses are being built smaller. Well, why? Because they're more expensive. And when you think about it, we've been talking about this a long time. A lot of people's master bedrooms are auditoriums. You could play a football game in there. I mean, you would throw the football at the TV to turn it off at night because you have to get up and walk 100 meters to get to it. And that's just true. In almost all new houses that have been built in the last 10 years, the master bedroom, when you walk into it, there's a king-size bed in the middle of it, and there's huge areas of space around it. And most people spend very little time in that room. As an economist, I have commented on this a lot. This doesn't make any sense. I don't want people to live in a closet either, but having an auditorium doesn't make any sense. And it was just kind of the standard on the plans. Well, we're seeing that shrink. It's based on numbers. It's based on dollars. If it costs more to have a big room, then the big rooms get smaller. And if it costs the same to have a big room, then you just keep a big room. That's why we kept getting bigger and bigger rooms, is because it wasn't that expensive to make them. Well, now everything about building a house, from labor to the products to the loans, every aspect of it is more expensive. So people are requesting less. The area of the housing market that has the least amount of downside in it, no downside at the national level, it's still up. The national housing is down across the board for houses, except if your house is worth $250,000 or less. That group of houses, there's not enough of them. As soon as they go on the market, they get purchased, and that's still the case. So it may be that the people that were buying them 2 years ago aren't the people buying them today. It could be they were trying to buy a more expensive house, but interest rates went up, and now they want the less expensive house. So the houses that are being built more and more are concentrating there. It's not as quickly as it should be, because the market takes a long time to switch. People that build houses generally aren't looking at the housing market. I know that's weird. They're generally not looking at what houses are in demand when they build the houses. They're building the houses that were successful the last time they built houses. This is how most business decisions get made. So it takes a while for it to filter into the builders to say, oh, we need to make them smaller. Well, they're starting that, and it's going to continue. And the reality is that's not really a sacrifice, because we're not utilizing the space. Okay, so that is my other area of strangeness. Now, I have not touched on unions, but I want to hand another subject over to you. Otherwise, I'm going to go one after another, and then people are going to get sick of younger Baldy's voice and say, where is he? Do you have him stuck in the basement?
I'm actually enjoying listening to you.
Oh, wow. That makes one of us. All right, I'll hit the unions while you do that. Okay. I'm not actually going to hit the unions. If you heard that and you work for the Teamsters and you're in the organized side of that deals with other issues, and if you're please don't meet me late at night on the road. I'm not actually going to hit the unions. I'm just going to cover the subject. Okay, so we've had some big union news lately. Union strike at a big coal plant that's been going for years ended. And it ended with the union saying, we would like to just accept the contract that we had before we started the strike. Complete capitulation at a coal plant. The UAW, that's the United Auto Workers, are doing a strike against Stellantis. They make Jeep, against Ford, and against General Motors. Now, there's all kinds of pieces to that are things that the Justice Department should have an eyeball on, because when you shut down half of the industry, half of the United States auto builders are to be shut down in this strike when it starts on Thursday. That's antitrust land. That's like if the air traffic control folks shut down, it shuts down the industry. It's not as direct and immediate, but we will see car prices go up across the board again. We will see used cars become more expensive than new cars again, because there won't be enough new cars. It's just, that's the way it will be. What's going on here? The United Auto Workers have said clearly that the reason for the strike has more to do with saving jobs than about the contracts themselves, than about the pay raises that they're asking for. When the Teamsters did their strike against UPS, and that ended with this tremendous salary of $170,000 a year for UPS drivers, there's dangers there. And that UPS is a direct competitor with FedEx. But Amazon is in the process of becoming possibly a competitor as well. They may become a shipping company that's not just shipping Amazon products because they have an infrastructure now. They've been utilizing the U.S. mail and the UPS, but they're utilizing them less and less because they have their own people doing it. And UPS is becoming more expensive because they've had to raise their pay. So put that all together, and we have a weirdness going on where unions tend to hit right at a time when new competition is available. The coal workers, when they went on strike, they were fighting the tide. When natural gas becomes less expensive than coal, and eventually wind and battery or solar and battery becomes less expensive than natural gas, for whatever reason, if technology moves that way and someone goes on strike to protect coal, it's never going to work because coal's more expensive. And that's just the reality of technology. The United Auto Workers are trying to protect the jobs of the internal combustion factory workers, the guys and gals that are out there building cars that have lots and lots and lots of parts to control all the little explosions that take place that get us down the road if we're not driving an electric car. And they're seeing the writing on the wall. It's written pretty clean, very legibly. A lot of money is being spent on developing electric cars because the technology is already passing up internal combustion. It's not at the place where it's going to be the best yet in all cases. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say electric's better than internal combustion. It isn't yet, but technology is coming, and it is a tidal wave. This isn't me saying I think so. There's the potential for making more efficiencies in electric cars is far more than the potential for the making more efficiencies in internal combustion. We've been working on those things for 100 years. And we've made them pretty efficient. We can probably continue to make them incrementally more efficient, but the electric side is coming out with exponentially more efficient. It's the difference between a tube television and a flat panel. At the beginning, the flat panels were far more expensive than the huge Curtis Mathis, same size, because it was like, whoa, it's flat. That's way expensive, but wow, I want to have that. Eventually, they became less expensive than the huge Curtis Mathis, and nobody bought the huge Curtis Mathis anymore. That's the reality of technology, is if it's less expensive to drive a car electrically, then more people do it that way. And that's what happens when technology shifts. And if the union says, hey, I'm about to lose my job, you can't pay me less just because you're not making a profit on what I do anymore, either the company fails, they fire all the union folks, or, I mean, there's not a solution there. And it's unfortunate because there are times when unions are the most important part of a business. Wait, I know all of the people out there listening just heard me do a complete turnaround, 180 from what I was saying, knocking on the unions. The unions exist for a reason, because corporations without a check and a balance become monsters. We know this. We look at it in history. The unions formed at a time when even mentioning that you might join a union could cause you to die. That's not hyperbole. You were actually killed by your employer. Forget about firing. Let's take it the termination title to a whole new level. So unions exist for a very valid reason. We have a lot of labor laws that exist because of unions. And sometimes unions do things, in fact, I would almost say majority of times, unions do things that are detrimental to business now. That in order to protect workers, they say, well, you're going to have less profit. Well, that's detrimental to business. But in an ecosystem where you want to keep good employees and there's not enough to go around, that makes sense. So unions also do their strikes when labor is tight. There's not enough workers to go around, so we need more money. You got to pay us. The problem with that, as we saw at the coal mining strike, is that they hired people to come in, they produced less coal, but they maintained record profitability at the company. So it didn't affect them. If you go on strike and you say, we're not going to build any more internal combustion cars, when you're in the process of building less internal combustion cars, you're accelerating the shift to the new technology, not slowing it down. Now, the opposite end of that is when a governmental organization, whether it be a country or a state like California or Germany, saying any new car purchased after X date has to be this new technology. That actually slows the technology down because it's not as efficient because it's mandatory. So you have less competition in making the absolute best of it. If you're required to get a solar panel, no matter what its efficiency, then why is the company trying to sell you the most efficient model? They don't even have to develop a more efficient model because the government says you have to buy it. So there's two extremes, and they both sound liberal. The unions accelerate the shift to a new technology by making the old technology more expensive at a time when the price needs to drop. And yet the governments decelerate the same technologies by making mandates that cause the companies to say, I don't even have to develop new technology because you're required to buy from me. Now, in the United States, hopefully it's only going to be a couple of states that say it's a mandatory requirement so we have good competition and keep prices down and so on. Just let the market do it, guys. Anyway, the unions are, I mean, this moment in history, this time period coming out of the pandemic is one we'll be studying for labor in economics probably for centuries. It is vitally important new data. And at the same time, we've got repetition of stuff that's happened throughout history when the union, basically, it's flexing its muscle in an industry that's dying. And when it flexes its muscle in an industry that dies, it accelerates the death. And we've got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join the program, we have email addresses waiting. We've got about a little over 10 minutes left after commercials. The email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important announcements. Back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. We got about 10 minutes left this week, so if you want to send in a question, it's a great time for it. Have you seen the building in, I think it's in Marfa, Texas? It's an adobe building, as they make buildings in West Texas, that has the sign in front of it that just says Photoshop.
No, I haven't, but it makes very good sense.
What is that? Well, that's the Adobe Photoshop over there, right there.
Right.
Do you need an upgrade to that? Put some more mud on it. It'll be good.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay.
Well,
so on to you.
One other thing, you know, this is the 25th anniversary of something we've come to depend on that didn't exist before.
September 23rd, 1998.
Approximately. It's in the 20s, early 20s of 1998. Do you remember what happened?
I do, as a matter of fact. It's the Asian contagion, the
long-term capital management.
Yeah, I know this because I'm on a first-name basis with one of the people that did it, and he's very humble about it, but he's got a Nobel Prize as well. He's very...
What happened in that crisis for the first time in American history?
The Federal Reserve stepped in and bailed out a hedge fund instead of a bank.
Right, and then it lowered interest rates, not because the economy was in trouble.
Right, it didn't actually bail out the hedge fund. It dumped money into the market to prevent a hedge fund collapse from cratering the economy.
Yeah, and we have gotten used to that over the last 25 years, that if the stock market takes a nosedive, the Fed will react and bail us out.
Are you proud that your son, by the way, young Baldy is the son of older Baldy. Are you proud that I knew what you were talking about when you started this?
I figured you would. I wouldn't have asked. I'm like a lawyer. I rarely ask a question that I don't know the answer to. Then I don't know what the answer will be.
Yeah, long-term capital.
I wanted to brag on you a little bit that you were in the middle of that.
Yeah, they got into currency manipulation, and they were making a really good profit for a long time, and then they collapsed the economies and currencies of most of Asia, and it almost spread to the whole world. And the Federal Reserve helped to stop that.
And at this point in time, they're doing that less and less and less. But there's an assumption in the markets that what's called the Fed put, which cushions the downside, is always lurking out there in the background. And of course, the reason is the Federal Reserve understands, and historically it's true, a stock market crash typically is the strongest single predictor of a major recession. And they're on top of it. It's just interesting that we've come to depend on something. We've come to just assume that it's going to happen when it didn't happen before 25 years ago. And they're talking less and less about it happening in the future, but we'll see. It is something that is different in the economy that we haven't seen in a long time. I mentioned earlier the PMI report, and also in the newsletter, we mentioned that the Fed has doing a prediction of rates for the next several years. And basically, the Fed is no longer in the position of saying we're going to have a recession. I think they're running ahead of the pack here. They are saying we will have a growth slowdown in 2024, so that for the year, the economy only grows 1.5%, and then it accelerates back up to growing about 1.8%, which seems to be pretty close, or 2% seems to be pretty close to the max out there. I personally love that. I think it's true. And why do I think that? Because I have seen what leads up to recessions and market crashes and recessions enough in my life to recognize that the wall of worry that a bull market climbs is still very much in place. There are still lots of naysayers. There's still lots of money that hasn't gone into the stock market that people want to have high gains on, and they're just holding on to it. There is not this, this can go on forever, the sense that the market is at record highs. There are some ways in which this resembles the late 1990s, but there's other ways in which it doesn't at all. The bottom line to it is we're in a whole new world. As we come to the end of the hour, it's a good idea to remind people of that. I like what one of the voting members of the Federal Reserve said, we are navigating by the stars in an overcast sky.
Makes sense.
And that is where we are, folks. We've got so many conflicting signals out there in the economy by the statistical data. On the other hand, again, if you want to know how the economy is doing at a given moment, just try to drive on I-35 or something similar.
Right. And I'm going to throw this in here because I think it's important. People were talking about we were either going to have a recession or a soft landing. And that one of the options wasn't listed, that we weren't going to land at all, that we were going to continue to grow just slower. So the Federal Reserve, they could have very easily gone too fast and put us into a recession. It's still a possibility. We don't see that as happening, but it's a possibility out there. We could go into a recession from all of this stuff. But the big a year ago, people were saying we're either going to go into a recession or somehow he's going to pilot us into that Powell was going to carefully guide us down, and without a crash landing, we were just going to land the airplane and everything was going to be okay. We're still flying and we're still making our regularly scheduled stops. We haven't had to do a soft landing. We're still growing. So this was the third option wasn't even in discussion a year ago.
Right.
And that's where we are. And that is phenomenal. We can't give all of the credit to the Fed, but we can give a lot of the credit to the Fed for two major events, avoiding a depression. Government's involved as well there, in that we threw a bunch of money at the stimulus level. But the Federal Reserve also stimulated the economy during that time period, and they did it first.
And it's putting that in context. There's three major economic entities in the world today: the United States, the European Union, and China.
That's right. Those are the three blocks.
And the European Union is coasting along on the edge of a recession, if not in a recession. They have significantly higher inflation than we have.
Yes. The UK was just made a statement that their inflation came in much lower than expected. And they were very rejoicing about that. And it came in at 6.7%.
Yeah.
Where we're at 3%, and we're going, what? You're happy about that?
And China, on the other side of the world, is running a completely different experiment, centrally controlling everything. And they're coasting along on the edge of deflation and a severe recession. We, on the other hand, and we've mentioned this before, but it's good to keep it in context, in our chaotic, stupid, weird economy that we have, we are accelerating. And that is, it continues to be mind-boggling to me that it works. I'm sure it's mind-boggling to the people in China and Europe who are trying to figure this stuff out. But you need to thank God that you're living in the United States of America right now with all our warts and pimples. And we are running out of time for the second hour.
So the wrap-up. Wrap-up is the same wrap-up that we tend to give all the time, except I'm not wrapping up the news. I'm giving you some quick educational, keep your savings up, your debt down, live within your means.
I like to quote Mark Zandi here. Third quarter U.S. growth will likely remain buoyant at near 3 or 4%, putting year-over-year growth at near potential 2.5%. Inflation continues to moderate and consumer spending remains steadfast as households after inflation incomes rise. Debate over how much excess savings computer has is irrelevant.
Yeah.
We're in pretty good shape. Consumer confidence is holding up. Everything really looks good to us.
Yeah. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we're out of time. We have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111
and toll free at 1-800-914-PLAN. We give fiduciary investment advice at the high net worth level and also do portfolio management. If you would like to talk to us otherwise, you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, sign up for it. You can listen to our radio program and podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. Contact us through the contact form or Jeff and or Jake at tpwc.com. Thanks for listening. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.